All those dollars are where we have beef cattle research being conducted in the within our university system, and we heard about the land grant colleges somewhat decreasing support to their industries, and I don't think that's happened in Nebraska. And with the leadership we currently have, I don't think it's going to happen. Nebraska is the number one fed cattle state, number one red meat production. We have more irrigated acres in Nebraska than any other state in the United States, and there's more variation from east to west coast than there is from the eastern part of Nebraska to the Atlantic Ocean. So there's a lot of interest in water research, both crops and livestock and sustainability. The Goodmanson Ranch is up here in the Sandhills, and some of the work we're going to talk about today will be derived from that great resource that we have. We also have elk in Nebraska. We treat them a little bit differently than I've seen them treated in the mountains, but I had to go to Louisville, Kentucky to get a picture taken 5 miles from my house, but this is in a feedlot along the South Platte River. And another, I guess, side note on the feeding industry, Nebraska has increased feeding capacity, where all the other states have gone down. We've built new feedlots in the last several years. The Goodmanson Sandhills Laboratory lies above one of the richest water resources in the United States, the Ogallala Aquifer. The reason we have a lot of irrigation in Nebraska, that ranch is about 13,000 acres. We run about 700 crossbred Red Angus Simmental females. In a beautiful place, we had our field day there here a week ago, had about close to 300 people at it. And if you're not going to Keneally's Bull Sale, you probably won't ever drive anywhere near it. But it's a great resource, well supported by the industry. That building down here in the corner was built by all private funds from the Wagonhammer Ranches. We also have these things, which quite honestly, coming from North Dakota, make me a little bit nervous. And I tell people, I moved from North Dakota and you got 5 national champion football rings on your finger, and it's due to a Nebraska football coach. But so far things have started off okay. We haven't had but one game. We know what's happened in the last several years. Cattle numbers have dropped, but we've been able to sustain beef production out till about 2009. But what happened since then? We have not sustained beef cattle production, because a lot of that sustained beef cattle production was cull cows that were culled because of the drought. So we don't have the numbers today, but we have built the cow herd considerably, and I think that is relevant discussion for this heifer development. The industry's been concerned, though, about the declining numbers and the infrastructure of the industry. I was involved several years ago with a group we brought into JBS to discuss challenges and opportunities with the heifer enterprise. And Tom Brink, who was with JBS at the time, he said, yeah, we're very concerned. We have to get a lot of feeder cattle every week. The largest feeding company in probably in the world, JFK Holdings, 970,000 head of cattle on feed. They buy 35,000 head of feeder cattle every week and feed 2 million bushels of corn. And they said, we are very concerned about where our cattle are going to come from. The Cooner Yard outside of Kersey, I thought would be bulldozed to the ground when I drove up there, but they rebuilt it by putting it on the stock market. Tom gave a talk, and hopefully you read this, because the major beef press magazines were there, on 10 good reasons to expose more heifers during the next few years, and 2 notes of caution. And one of those cautionary notes was expensive feed resources and drought, all of which we got to see across the United States. He said it's a great time to own cows if you have a competitive cost structure and the right genetics and management to compete in today's marketplace. And I think that's where we're at today. You know, when we got $1,300, $1,500 steer calves, we're not really concerned about production input costs. But when they drop $500 or more in a year, we are. If we look around the world and heifer development systems, it's largely forage-based. And I think there's some real relevancy for that heifer to be developed on an environment that she's going to have to live on as a cow. And save the feedlot for those cattle that are going to be confined and fed a finishing diet and intended for slaughter. We all know what's going on down in south of us and the relaxation of imports from some South American countries. If we look over across a little further away, also very forage-based, both heifer development and bull. Tamania, one of the biggest Angus ranches in Australia, they develop all their bulls on forage grazing. And then here's some red Brangus heifers down a little bit farther south. And even in the United States, if you look at the large beef production operations, they are largely forage-based from all the way from birth to essentially breeding that female again. And this is down in the largest cow herd in the United States, stands 46,000 cows south of Orlando. A lot of the work we've done is looking at relevant questions for beef cattle operations, but understanding how those decisions in one segment can impact another segment of the development system. And one of those systems is heifers. When we look at building cattle numbers, I do a lot of talks on how we can just increase reproductive efficiency, because if you think about retaining a heifer till she's a productive female and weans a calf and produces a feeder animal that goes to slaughter, that's a long time compared to if we can increase pregnancy rate 1% in the United States, we'd have another 300,000 head of cattle fairly quickly. I think today we're at kind of a crossroads where we're starting to look at production costs and some measurements of efficiency within our production system. I don't know if Matt Spangler's arrived yet, but you can challenge him tomorrow. When I saw him show this slide, I said, Matt, please send me that slide that shows how insignificant genetics are and how important reproduction is to our beef industry. And he said, doesn't exist, but it does. Because this is in his slide set, he probably won't show it in front of a bunch of repro people tomorrow. But he says, by simply increasing number of progeny per dam through either selection, heterosis from crossing, or better management, will increase efficiency of production. It's all about numbers. I don't care if I have a calf that's going to great choice or prime if I don't have a live calf, right? Well, one of the costs that really relates to this topic of mine based on longevity is the second biggest cost to beef production that we often don't think about. Feed cost, obviously, number one, but cow depreciation is a real close number two. It's frequently the second largest cost in beef cattle production. And if we look at the formula for depreciation, what we divide by is the productive life of the females. So we have those other factors that go into the depreciation, but how long that heifer's around really influences how we spread that depreciation out, because it's that change in initial placement cost of a female to what we salvage her out at. And it can be very expensive if she's not around very long. So this longevity to the beef industry is a very important trait that involves a lot of genes. And it's been very difficult to make a lot of change in. And some of the management things that John talked about and others will at this conference can definitely influence that. And I'm going to talk about several of those. So what is a productive life? The average cow age is only about 5.5 years. And at a 16% replacement rate, a cow will on average wean 4.5 to 5 calves, barely enough to pay for herself. And then she's gone. So what if we change that? Andy Roberts has done some talks at National Animal Science on can we increase the cow herd through longevity. And this slide, it goes from a 20 to a 15% replacement rate. Well, we have 8% increase in cows that are 5 years or older, a 6% increase in weaning weight, a 16% increase in pounds of calf to sell, and those older females breed back better. So there's a huge opportunity or payout if we can improve longevity. Before we start talking about some of these management practices and things that influence that trait, I think what's the relevant question? What is the appropriate female for a ranch? And the question usually comes up of the debate of buying versus raising replacement heifers. I think it needs to go beyond that. I think that factor of some other alternate replacement female needs to come into play at some point. Maybe it isn't an overpriced first calf heifer pair that I can't get rebred. Maybe it's a cow that's had two or three calves. And there's some big ranches in Nebraska that have gone to that system. They don't keep any replacement females. They go to a terminal sire system, and they outsource all their replacements in the form of some pairs that are maybe had two or three calves. And that brings up an interesting point of there's a lot of small herds as we move east in the United States, and how much opportunity cost is being given up to keep a 15% replacement rate. 85% of the genetic decisions on a ranch are made for a 15% replacement rate. And you factor in going to a terminal sire system, I think largely that can far outweigh keeping replacement heifers. And we just breed everything terminal and go to some high-performance bulls, and we're doing that with a part of the herd at the ranch. And I think about that, I think inadvertently, in many cases, producers are doing that, but they're keeping replacement heifers. And I've been asked, why haven't weaning weights and yearling weights changed since we see all this mark data showing a steady incline? And they have on some cases. We know what happens when they go to the feedlot, right? When they can get all the resources they need. We produce 2,000, 2,500-pound steer calves going out when their cattle are retained for a long time. But people like Jay Wolf on the Wagonhammer Ranch says, my weaning weights haven't changed in 20 years. And we see this trend for weaning and yearling weight. And I said, well, how many cows do you put on a section today versus 20 years ago? And it's the same number. We haven't allowed the resources to change to express that increased genetic potential that's there. Well, another question, what about selecting heifers? John gave some good tips on that, but I'm going to go back to a couple slides that Jim Gosey had several years ago. He said, Cola daughters of bad mark cows, which are cows that need help calving, that calve late, that fail to wean a calf, that have problems nursing, and wean a lightweight calf and have attitude problems. And beyond that, he says, cull the daughters of the bad mark cows, but cull the lightweights, the big birth, and the big frame cattle, and get rid of the youngest ones. Isn't that a good management option? And select daughters of the oldest cows. How many agree with that? Where's your best genetics supposed to be in your herd? It's supposed to come from your youngest cows, right? But if you look at collectively the genetic contribution of any one female, especially to a commercial ranch, is minimal compared to the sire effect. 85% of the genetic change in a herd occurs on the sire side. So if we could select females that are from mothers that have proven that she can live in an environment that you put her in, and we could increase longevity, it'll far outweigh any genetic quote-unquote progress that we're making. And then some more functional things, pigmented eyes and udders, and have cattle that can eat a lot of poor quality forage. Why are there so many cows in the sandhills in Nebraska? So yet, other than tourism and Ted Turner, it's not in competition with a lot of other resources. And I think that that number five is very important. Jim said this long before we did the research. He says an optimum, not maximum, preg rate. Why do we need a high percent pregnancy rate in our first or in our replacement females? Because we don't keep more than we need. So we feed them a lot, get them all pregnant, and then wonder why they don't breed back. We expose every heifer on that Goodmanson Ranch to be a potential candidate to go into the herd. But I don't want better than 85, 86% pregnancy rate in our heifer calves. If you're ever going to have an open female on a ranch that's profitable or has the potential to be profitable, it better be one that never got pregnant ever. John mentioned some of this data on the importance of looking at heifers that are born early. Those heifers, we segregated this out on heifers that are born in the first, second, or third cycle. I mean, it makes sense, right? And we saw an equation this morning to calculate how many pounds per day that is for a cycle. Those heifers are older, heavier at breeding, or at weaning, more cycling at breeding. They have higher preg rate. They calve earlier and have heavier calves at weaning and breed back sooner. So collectively, age has a huge impact on profitability of a ranch. And I have a steer slide and another slide set that shows those steers are impacted clear to slaughter by when they were born. And we have great tools to front load that calving season, right, that were talked about this morning. You'll see this slide too many times now that John has it in his talk. But when cattle conceive, so age doesn't explain all the variation of when an animal will become pregnant. Some of those younger heifers will get pregnant along with the older ones. But again, this is some of Bob's data from Mark that showed that when that heifer got pregnant, her first time improved longevity. So maybe if we focused on factors that influence initial pregnancy timing, we could have a big impact on longevity. And a lot of the tools that you're going to learn at this conference will do that. And that heifer that calved or conceived in her first cycle, her first time, effectively weaned another two calves by the time she got to her sixth calf. And this is some data from Colorado State looking at the importance of time of conception. The blue bar was heifers that conceived AI versus those that conceived natural service. And again, lifetime, they weaned another two calves. And that heifer that calves early in the calving season, the chance that she's going to be open the next year is much less than if she calves late in the calving season. And it takes a profit from two early calving cows to cover the loss of one late calving cow. And again, Harlan Hughes' name was mentioned, but a cow that calves in her first cycle her entire life will essentially wean you two more calves in her lifetime. That event, and cost you the same, right? That cow that calves later, you don't feed her any less, do you? And I think we saw pieces of this already. And many of you in here, Dave Patterson and Bob Bells, have been best good friends for a long time. I had the opportunity to work with two of the Bobs at Miles City, Bob Short and Bob Bellows, before they retired. But this was an older paper that Bellows had, and I think he was way ahead of his time because we're only now beginning to learn that management of all these phases of potential lifetime of a heifer calf, even when it's an embryo, can influence productivity. You heard John talk about the period from calving to weaning being very important, and maybe explaining more of the variation in age at puberty than the segment that we manage, which is from weaning to breeding, right? And I'll talk at the end here about that initial component or early on development, even before that heifer calf is born, can influence its first service pregnancy rate or whether it gets pregnant at all. And this old target, we didn't show this, maybe this is part of Patterson's data, but these heifer calves were weaned in the fall of 1964. And we've taken this for gospel for far too long. Because genetics have changed, haven't they? You heard about precocious puberty, about heifers getting pregnant on the cow. So yeah, that's some of the work that Gene Deitcher started before I came to North Platte, looked at this lighter target weight, and found there was no difference in pregnancy rate. But if we look at longevity, those lighter heifers had similar longevity as those heifers developed to a heavier target weight. And I tell people to do the math. You heard some or saw some weight ranges on recommendations for heifer development. But if you look at a weaning weight of a heifer and when you need to breed her, you got a long time to get there. And even if you're not comfortable with that 55%, a heifer never has to gain over a pound and a half a day. But that largely isn't what happens. And pattern, again, can also influence these heifers' longevity. But this is all getting to the same target weight. But if we look at the bottom blue line, a lower rate of gain than moving up into breeding, we do it with less feed, those cattle are more efficient, we have greater first service conception rate. That flushing effect is very real. It isn't like in sheep where you increase twinning, but it is very real in that changing from that lower to a higher nutrient environment going into breeding actually increases first service conception rate. and longevity. So these heifers on the low high, and that was just during from weaning to breeding, that they were imposed with that lower plane of nutrition then moved up into breeding. And the low tells me one of two things. We've had different debates or ways of restricting heifers. In all of our research, we restrict quality of feed. In some of Andy's work at Miles City, it's been quantity as well. In this case, these heifers were never restricted quantity of feed. So if they're gaining a low amount, that tells me they were fed something that was not very high in protein and energy. Something maybe like grazing winter grass or corn residue. But that high treatment would be something probably with an artificial resource that isn't necessarily all from a grazing environment, like corn silage, distiller's grains, alfalfa hay, that we feed heifers and lock them up and get them all pregnant, and then say, oh, by the way, you're never going to see that again. So we've looked at a lot of systems. We've got the highest grass prices probably in the world in Nebraska, and they got to come down with cattle prices coming down. But collectively as a beef team, we're looking at alternatives to maintain or grow our cow herd. And the one resource we got a lot of that we don't use all of is what you see here, corn residue. And there's a lot in Nebraska. Sadly, a lot of the unused residue is in the eastern part of the state where there aren't cows. But as a beef team, we're looking at the expanded use of cover crops. You know, farmers, when they got $3 corn, they're a lot easier to listen to a rancher that wants to bring cows and put on corn stalks, or plant an alternative crop after they've taken silage off a field or something. It's a whole different mindset. We only use less than 25% of the corn residue in Nebraska. Here's some of our lighter heifers. And I think largely this is why we don't adopt a practice like this, because they're restricted in growth. And how many of you like how those heifers look, and that you would have a neighbor drive to your place and you'd be proud to show them off? How about those heifers? They're the same heifers. And that compensatory gain thing that the yearling systems take huge advantage of, do they overwinter yearling cattle gaining 3 or 4 pounds a day? No, because they know that ain't going to happen when they go, and George will talk more about that, but they know that gain won't be sustained because it won't be sustained on grass. This is some work with more straight bred Angus heifers. And they were either developed in a dry lot or on corn residue. And commercial heifers, AI'd. Here's body weight, different by design. Those corn residue heifers were lighter, less cycling prior to breeding. Here's the gain in the period immediately before the heifers coming home from corn residue. And then when they were placed together in the lot and synchronized with MGA, and then when they went to grass together. And you see those lighter heifers beyond that dry lot period outgained those heifers that were locked up. And this was an interesting thing that led to another study we did. If you look at the dry lot heifers, what did they do grazing corn residue as a pregnant heifer? They came home weighing the same or less, and the heifers that were developed on corn residue came home heavier. Somebody asked about AI in these lighter heifers. Here's heifers on stocks versus dry lot. We had 10% higher conception rate to AI on the heifers on corn residue. And why was that? Here's what happened after they went to grass. So heifers on corn residue gaining less than a pound a day, and the heifers in the dry lot at what we were recommending, something around a pound and a half. But we synchronize and breed these all together. They go out to pasture in the same pasture with cleanup bulls, and in that 45-day period from AI to first pregnancy diagnosis, we see those heifers developed on corn stalks consistently gain from a half to 8/10 of a pound a day more. and they're grazing in the same pasture, side by side. Part of it's compensatory gain, but we could argue whether feeding heifers at a pound and a half a day is really going to realize a lot of compensatory gain. And they're more efficient as a bred heifer. So here's a study we published a few years ago looking at these two development systems with heifers that were on winter grass for a little while but then locked up versus heifers that grazed winter range and then went to corn stalks and back to winter grass. We see some spread and difference in body weight during development, but we had tendency for higher AI conception rate. And again, it's because of what's happening post-breeding. And that's another period that I don't know. Yeah, it's on that graph of Bellows. But that period post-breeding, importance of gain has probably been very underestimated as far as its importance. And like in most mammals, fertilization rate is really high, like over 90%. But we lose 30 to 40% of the embryos before day 40. And a lot of that is because of embryonic loss. If we lock heifers up and breed them, and then they go to an environment that they don't sustain that gain that they were on, we believe there's greater embryonic mortality. But here's an interesting, if you look at average daily gain, and that's in kilograms, so basically double it, the heifers developed on corn stalks outgained the heifers developed on dry lot, and this is when they were a pregnant heifer, by almost 3/10 of a pound a day. So can we make an animal that utilizes the cheaper resource by developing her on it so we don't have to supplement as much as a pregnant heifer was a question we asked. And we've got ranches that have gone to that. Here's 750 cows on a pivot, and they still got their calves on them. Those calves stayed with them until they come off corn residue. And John Maddox is a firm believer now that those calves learn from their mothers. I was giving a talk at Kansas City, some of you were at a few weeks ago, Russ is here, and the guy from Cactus that's got the cow lot in Syracuse, Sandy, he said the heifer calves that are raised in the dry lot, or any of the calves for that matter, when they take them or ever try to take them to grass, they don't know what to do. They've never seen anything but a feed truck. So a naive animal going to a resource that's probably pretty inexpensive, this is our cheapest feed resource, if we develop them on that resource, their performance is greater as a bred heifer. So in our research, we've seen we can lower development costs considerably depending on feed costs. And this enterprise has been profitable by keeping all the heifers and exposing them for a short time or a long time if the bred market justifies. I know when we're trying to build the cow herd, which probably isn't today because cattle prices, I mean, it's evident we've built the cow herd some. But if there's a better market for a pregnant female, why pull the bulls? Let your vet pull the bulls. Only keep the ones that were bred in the first cycle and use the others as marketing opportunities. But if feeder market is similar to what the bred market's going to be, then we probably need to just have a short breeding season. And we found that with a short breeding season and lighter target weights, we see those cattle, or we identify ones that are more adaptable to the environment they're going to have to live on as a cow. But I do give some caution here. They have to continue to grow through calving. We have a May calving herd, and those heifer calves and bred heifers have a 20 to 30% lower conception rate than our March herd. And that challenge we're trying to address with some grazing management strategies. But as we calve later and later in the sand hills, i.e. breed later and later, what's forage quality doing? It's going the wrong way. And those young females just can't eat enough of that low-quality forage. And we don't think it's a heat issue. I get that all the time. We don't have this humidity like you do. The older cows, we can get bred anytime. want to show you a couple other studies. This is Travis Molinex looking at developing heifers, and I think, John, this was the same study you showed, developing heifers either in a dry lot or on range, but they got to a similar target weight. I think that's an important part of this study. And they used a bypass protein, but to a similar target weight. And they were, I guess, slightly higher target weight on the feedlot. This sure looked very similar. But if we go to longevity that we're talking about, these heifers, and I would argue that wasn't all due to the protein source. Those heifers developed on range, if you look at retention rate, is much greater over out to 5 years of age than those heifers that were locked up in the dry lot. This is one we haven't even addressed as an industry that I think's causing some issues, especially in a limited resource environment. What are we doing by increasing growth potential and milk potential to longevity in these extensive range environments? Here's some literature that Travis sent me. Said suggested that ewes maintained under extensive range environments may not express their maternal production potential due to limitations in feed intake, and a high genetic value for growth and size may have or may leave the herd because they're either phenotypically appear to be because they either phenotypically appear to be unfit for breeding. So this was some work, and we were visiting earlier about when Travis moved to Tennessee, they had a cow herd that they segregated by milk production potential. And interesting to me, those cows didn't produce any more weaning weight. So I don't know the reason for that. His theory is that that calf will express its genetic potential with increased intake of forages. And I don't know, quality of a high milk producing cow is as good as quality of a lesser. That could be part of it. But regardless, timed AI pregnancy rates and overall pregnancy rates were both lower for those high milk production potential cows. Andy Roberts, you heard his name mentioned, has been in this arena as well. He's looked at some different heifer development systems, lower or higher rates of gain with limited nutrient restriction. I think one of the interesting things, though, he's taken those females that were developed in those two systems and exposed their daughters to different nutrient environments, and then looked at what that does to longevity. And I think from this bottom line, one of the words of caution is, if you adequately feed a female during development, you better not restrict its offspring postnatally. And this leads to some of the discussions on, is what's happening in utero also playing a role on this heifer's lifetime productivity in fetal programming? And what he saw is that these marginal heifers during development that are then restricted, they don't have any difference in longevity. But that environment was consistent, right? But over years, what he's seen is the production output has gone down. That they're having lighter birth weight calves, same genetics, lighter birth weight calves and lighter weaning weights, adjusting to that limited resource environment. Well, we've looked at a lot of systems to try to help producers deal with production costs, and one of them is with harvested forage needs. And this was the initial study that led to a lot of the findings that we have had that shows that not only are we affecting the immediate animal, but potentially the offspring by how they're managed. So these cows were wintered with nothing. The ones with the yellow line, the red line got a pound of a 42% cube. Why were we feeding them? Feeding them for an outcome of their breeding back, right? And there's been like 14 years of research that we see no benefit of supplementing that cow for the reason that we think we're supplementing her, which is for her rebreeding performance. But we see a difference in fertility in the daughters from cows that aren't supplemented. And we see a difference in carcass weight and live weight of steer calves born to cows that aren't supplemented. And quality grade. Feed efficiency is also impacted, but it's impacted in the other way. Those calves from cows that aren't supplemented are being programmed during gestation to say, when I get out of here, I'm not going to have many resources, so I better utilize them as efficiently as possible. So the consequences of nutrient restriction must be considered not only for the individual animal that we think we're impacting, but Junior here, who's not even born yet. And this, you're going to hear more about this from Dr. Cushman tomorrow, but this stimuli experienced during fetal development impacting postnatal growth and physiology has been termed fetal programming or developmental programming. We've known about it for a long time. This woman worries about the jackhammer noise down the street impacting her unborn child, not to mention insert your favorite brand of cigarette here. And maybe not just chronic long-term insults to the whatever hormone or things that are being programmed, but a rancher gave me this book, and this medical journalist documents cases of short-term catastrophic events like 9/11, like the hurricane victims, and how that impacted their children later in life. That after 9/11, there was an increase in the number of girl babies born. That there's a tribe of Aboriginals in Canada that don't have enough children to have boys to have a basketball team, that live in the vicinity of several industrial plants. That harsh environment is signaling for perpetuation of the species to have more girl babies. There certainly has to be a male component. And I get this question way too often. What about these terribly excess fleshy bulls that are put in front of me every spring to put into my cow herd? Well, they're making them that way because that's what the market signals are, right? But this study, sadly, had to go to the laboratory, but they made these mice either obese or normal, mated them to a random population of mice, and found that the pups sired by this big dude had metabolic issues measured postnatally. That something happened due to the condition of that rodent that impacted the DNA before conception ever occurred. So there is a male component. Kim Vanami borrowed this slide to me, but she says, smoking, taking prescription meds, or failing to eat a balanced diet can influence the health of men's future children. With the Olympics being over, bodes the question, when did Michael Phelps become a good swimmer? So with that, I'm going to end on Dave Patterson's favorite slides. From the heart of cattle country and the heart of the sand hills, here's 896 bred heifers on the Rex Ranch. Great resource there, beef website. And then my contact.